Everyday injustice. Too many wrongful convictions. Corruption has infected the criminal justice system, leaving too many people helpless, fighting for their lives instead of receiving justice. People suffer. Is that why they say justice is blind?
Today on Everyday Injustice, we have Michael Owens, who is joining us incarcerated in prison. And which prison are you at?
Mule Creek State Prison.
Okay. So Mike, kind of give us a little bit of your story, how you got to where you are now, and then talk about what you're doing now that you're in prison.
Over drugs, you know, and for that I was given double life without the possibility of parole. I entered the California Department of Corrections, angry, lost young man. And the early 90s was a really violent time in California prisons. I wish I could say I came to prison and the light bulb went on and I started to work and get myself together, but that wasn't my story. You know, I came and then participated fully in the nonsense that was going on in the California prison system at that. And it really took a lot of years for me to really begin to mature and for me to honestly just get tired of the violence, the betrayals, and the facade of the lifestyle that I had chosen. And thankfully, my story didn't end there. But as I grew and as I matured, when I just made the decision to walk away from gangs and crime, even behind these walls, my life bloomed. I got away from the violent yards, and I was able to get into education. I was able to start participating in some self-help groups, and I found out that, you know what, I had some things inside that I needed to deal with. I had wounds that needed healing, and I needed to be able to go and explore those wounds before any recovery for criminal behavior was even possible. I had to deal with my own stuff, and fortunately for me, I hit a yard, California State Prison, Sacramento, New Folsom, where they had a group that was called the Men's Support Group. And I owe that group so much because in that group, I found mentors of men who had walked the same walk that I had and had found true manhood and had found peace, even right in prison. A lot of them were LWOPs. A lot of them were lifers. And they were able to mentor me and they talked to me because it was a group created by and for knuckleheads, ran by knuckleheads. And I was a knucklehead. So they spoke my language, and they helped guide me into growth and manhood and who I am today.
Can you explain, and this question actually came up, and, you know, it's become part of the vernacular, but, you know, what is LWOP?
So LWOP is a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. It means natural life. It means that I will never have an opportunity to go to a parole board. I will never have an opportunity to get out of prison, barring a commutation by the governor or some other extraordinary action, recall by a judge or a DA, you know, but my sentence is to die in prison.
And psychologically, how does that play on your mind as you go through your life?
So I have to answer that in stages. Because the initial stage is, as you can imagine, is a little bit of denial of this can't be the end for me. You know, that's the early stage. And, you know, there's an appeal process anytime you're convicted of a crime. And, you know, I'm speaking generally. I can't speak for everybody, but generally, you know, once you receive LWOP, you go through the appeal process and you try to obviously find a loophole. It's just about trying to get out from up in that sentence. And then, it's a lot like the stages of mourning. It's really like a lot like the stages of Kubler-Ross. There's the shock, there's the denial, and then you move toward acceptance, and then that's where the real decision is, once the acceptance sits in. And so it's kind of like in phases. So those are the general phases, and my specific journey, you know, was probably specific to me.
So for you, once you got to this acceptance phase, what did you want to make your life be about?
I think first I had to make the decision on if I wanted to continue to live or not. And not to be dramatic, but really, that was really a decision I had to make was, do I want to continue to live here under this environment in this place? And once I decided that, yeah, I do, I want to see what's possible for me. I want to see if I can grow. I want to know what it's like to be authentic. And I wanted to know what it was like to be fully me, to the best I could be, who I was created to be on this planet. And so for me, that required healing. And healing required that I had to go back and face things that I'd been denying and not wanting to look at for a really long time.
And what was the toughest thing for you to overcome at that point?
I think the toughest thing for me, in two parts. One, it was to face the abuse that I suffered in early childhood that kind of set me on the path of turning my emotions off, of becoming a person that felt like I'm just not going to feel, which then made all my criminality much more easily because I denied, you know, my own heart, you know. So that was the first part. That was the toughest part. But the toughest thing in my recovery was when I allowed myself to really realize, and to feel the fact that the reason why I'm responsible for so much destruction in this world, in this community, was because I was a coward. I was afraid to face my own wounds. It was easier to turn my heart off and take out my pain on the world. That was very difficult to face.
And how old were you when you came to this kind of realization?
I was about 37 years old, 36.
And how long had you been in?
About 5 years. Oh, at that time, I had been in about 14 years. Yeah, no, 13 years.
So you were in your early to mid-20s when this happened, and it took you until your late 30s before you kind of reconciled yourself to this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And had I not had the exact experiences that I had, had I not found that men's support group, I have serious doubts that I would have gotten there when I did. It may have taken 13 more years had I not had that combination of mentors and environment.
So at this point, what does your life look like? What do you do with your time? How do you keep yourself motivated?
So, you know, my motivation is intrinsic. You know, it's today I'm living out who I am. I'm fully and authentically me, and I'm grateful for life. I'm grateful to life. And I'm humbled by the opportunities that I have today to live the way that I do. I know people always find this strange, but I am content with my life. Are there things I would like that I wish were different? Absolutely. But I'm content with my life today. I live a good life today. I'm in my last semester of a bachelor's program, a pilot bachelor's program with Sacramento State University. I've already applied. I've pre-applied for a master's program in the fall. I'm a certified domestic violence counselor. I teach guys here at the Batterers Intervention Program. We teach guys here how to get along with family, with intimate partners in their life. I'm an alcohol and drug specialist. I'm a registered alcohol and drug technician, so I provide one-on-one and group drug and alcohol refusal skills. I'm, you know, able to do some one-on-one mentoring. I work in a juvenile diversion program here at the prison where they bring in juveniles for weekend workshops, and we're able to take kids from underserved communities and at-risk kids, and we're able to put them through workshops that I've authored that we can kind of use our stories to kind of help them understand that this path is unnecessary, that we understand, the men that work in my program understand that these youngsters feel like their life is inevitable. That's how I felt for the majority of my life. I felt like my life, this ending, was inevitable. Prison or an early grave felt like what was destined for me, and was a lie.
Michael, I'm really wondering, you know, your decision to continue your education. Now, I assume, like a lot of people who end up incarcerated, you may not have even graduated from high school. What went into your decision to actually go to college and get a degree?
So you're correct. First off, you know, I didn't, I was expelled in the ninth grade, went to adult ed and then dropped out early on. I got my GED in Old Folsom in 1995. And I thought that was the extent of it. That felt, you know, good enough. You know, okay, I got my GED, I'm good. You know, what influenced my decision to go to higher education was once I came here to Mule Creek and got into the juvenile diversion program, you know, the opportunity existed through at the time it was the pilot program for Folsom Lake College, had a social work and human services certificate that they were offering. And I knew that that would make me a better mentor. And I really have a passion for the mentoring, coaching, and counseling work that I do with peers and with youth. And I knew that would make me better. It requires that you have to have some, you know, some education in theory and some application in group counseling skills. And they were offering those classes specifically. So I thought that I would just go and take those classes. I still wasn't even thinking degree. And as I got into those classes, I really discovered that I do have a love for education, and I can learn and I can succeed in an academic setting, which were all things that I doubted. And I doubted I would ever be able to complete a BA. I thought, okay, I can just get this certificate. But the bug got me. It bit me, man. And it changed for me once I got that AA under my belt. Then I was like, okay, there's a place for me in academia. And I discovered that there are degrees that will make me a better version of myself. You know, I'm a natural helper, and there are programs that will develop me to be a professional helper. And that was exciting to me. It was exciting to find out that there might be a place, a professional place in the world for my natural skill sets.
For a long time, a lot of prisons got rid of education programs, believing that that was, almost excessive. It's come back. Why is it so important for people that are incarcerated to be able to educate themselves beyond even a GED?
It's vital. It really is. I've seen how education really is a tool of rehabilitation and a tool of just growth. You know, first off, when you're in education, you have to be responsible because you're still going to have a job assignment. You're going to have deadlines for school. You're still going to have the demands of whatever your daily life is in here. And it requires you to have to balance those things. You know, you have to juggle them. You'll have to be, it helps your resilience. You know, if you have cellies, and some places you have multiple cellies, and you have to find places to study, and you have to put your nose to the grindstone and study in areas that aren't always conducive to study. And so it teaches you that type of dedication, focus, and resilience. I think it also prepares people. I've seen men, and myself included, find out that the thing they love doing most, there's actually a career path for that. And you don't have to go flip burgers because you're an ex-convict. You don't have to settle for a menial life. Like, the sky is truly the limit. I've been around long enough now to see men who had life go to parole board, earn a parole date, and now these guys are out there doing beautiful, transformative work in the community, and they're credible messengers because they walked this walk, and now they're out there leading restorative justice programs in the community, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
And, you know, to borrow another theme here, one of my pet peeves with how we've done criminal justice for way too long is that, you know, somebody does something bad, we lock them in a cage, and then we turn them out, at least the people that are able to be turned out, and we don't give them the skills to be able to be successful. And so what happens? Oh, they they go back to their lifestyle, and they're right back in there. And that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. And worse. And it's not even going home breaking even. One of the really insidious things about the prison that I entered in the early 90s was it didn't leave you neutral. You didn't come in and go home neutral. You know, you came in and you went home worse. You went home more sophisticated. You went home, you know, with new criminal connections. And a lot of times you went home now linked to not just a street gang, but a prison gang. And And so the way we did it was wrong. It was wrong. And I saw it and I felt it. And I remember my welcome speech, and I won't say the prison, and I won't say obviously the staff member's name, but the welcome speech was, you know, I was 19 and just coming into prison, and my welcome speech was, welcome to blank blank state prison. If you try to escape, we're going to kill you. If you try to hurt one of our officers, we're going to kill you. Everything else you need to know, your homeboys will tell you. Go play.
Yeah. That doesn't seem like a setting that's going to be conducive to rehabilitation.
No. And at that time, and in that era, you had maybe the only rehabilitative groups were maybe AA and maybe NA, and the wait lists were like 2 and 3 years long. And so thankfully, that's not the situation today. We're absolutely moving in the right direction, and I don't want to pretend that we're not. We're moving in the right direction. Do I want more and better changes? Absolutely. But I'm excited by the changes that I can see because I've been around long enough to see the other end of the pendulum.
And can you talk about what rehabilitation actually looks like for someone who is serving LWOP?
Okay. Yeah. You know, I think that for someone serving LWOP, because you have to come to that point of decision of, for me, there's likely not to be, you know, any relief from this sentence. You know, I think rehabilitation is firstly about coming to that point of acceptance that, okay, I'm right here. This is where I am. And this is my life right now. And how do I want to use it? And there's some baselines. I feel like the first baseline is to travel the journey of recovery, which leads to one location. And that one location is living a pro-social and productive lifestyle right now, right here, because there is no, you know, no later. And so I think that's finding what your passion is, finding what keeps you authentic, keeps you whole, and keeps you well, and participating in that. And not just participating in it, but finding ways to use that to serve, so that you're living a productive lifestyle, because so much of life is about just consuming. And I believe that we were created to be more than just consumers. We were meant to produce. And so I think that's the first prong. But I think if you're talking about objectively what it looks like, I think it looks like long-term psychiatric and behavioral stability. It's the ability to accept, you know, that in a lot of ways, this existence is going to be sad, and it's going to be a constant reminder of, you know, the crimes that we've committed to earn the sentence. And it's a constant reminder of the way that our victims' families are serving a life sentence. And I think that it's also finding the bittersweet joy in growth in life, in the ability to still participate in this thing called life.
So what happens after rehabilitation for LWOPs, or is there an after rehabilitation?
You know, I'm going to answer that in two ways too, because I believe that there's this strange dichotomy, because partly what comes after is still to be determined. And everyone has a say. I have a say in that I will continue. Today I got up and put my feet on the floor and said, okay, today is the day, and I'm going to make the best of today, and I'm going to be a better version of myself today than I was yesterday, and I'm going to live my life in such a way that people that come in contact with me are blessed by my presence. That's the prayer that I say. That's the meditation that I have every morning. So there's that. I have a saying that what comes after, because I'm creating it and I'm walking it out day by day. But I think that also those that run the Department of Corrections have a say, because they see us and they know who we are. And I think that you, the public, has a say in what comes after. I think that we have a lot of artificial boundaries up. The us versus them dichotomy is really one of the most damning falsehoods in all of society, because we are alike. We're all humans, all stumbling toward the light, and it's yet to be determined what's going to come after. I know that my job is to continue to get up, put my feet on the floor, and be a decent human being. So the other prong of how I could answer what comes after is I can say now, I'm personally frustrated some days, but I remain hopeful. I'm frustrated in the sense that even if I am not to get out, there are ways that I can serve and help those who are getting out. And I don't always feel as supported as I could be. And I can see the direct link between the quality of service that LWOPs are allowed to offer in prison and public safety, because we are the ones that are leading the job crews, that are running the groups, that are doing the peer mentoring. And I think that as we get better support, better training, better opportunities to live a fulfilling life in these service areas, the better service we can provide to the guys who are going home, the more they can focus on their rehabilitation and the reduced risk of them going home and reoffending. And I think that every LWOP that I know that is in rehabilitation, that is in recovery, that's their hope, that they can make a difference.
And you kind of anticipated what I was going to ask you, which was, you know, whether or not you feel supported by the system and the COs.
So, you know, not as a whole. I don't believe that as a whole, everyone is in lockstep with the California model. But I imagine that you never get everybody to buy in to an idea, no matter what industry or what lane you're talking about, right? So what I do is you know, we do have allies, though. There are people that absolutely believe in those of us that are doing the right thing and walking it out in the right way. And I think they support us, and that's how things get done. That's how we're able to establish groups. There are definitely key allies that kind of help us to be able to do what we do and help the population, because that's what we really want to do.
And Michael, what do you think is least understood about someone serving LWOP?
I think what's least understood, I think one of the things that's least understood is what it means to be without hope. I believe that LWOP is absolutely a form of the death penalty. And I know that, that, you know, I've seen people roll their eyes at that statement, like, well, you're not dead, so it's not the death penalty. But I think that life is about more than the body not being dead. Life is about the possibility of growth and renewal and hope. And I think LWOP, in a sense, is the death of hope. And hope is one of the vital aspects of being alive. I think that there's a paradox in that hope springs eternal, right? And we have found reason to hope, even if it's only in the growth that we are able to achieve, and that being the evidence that even though it is a death sentence, hope is still available if we're willing to fight for it, if we're willing to go all in on it. And that's I don't know if people understand that.
And it seems to me that there's kind of two sides to this, right? Because on the one hand, you know, We try to reserve LWOP for the people that are the most dangerous. On the other hand, clearly, you've experienced a ton of personal growth while you've been in there. And at this point, you probably are not a threat to anyone. But then there are going to be people that say, yeah, but you did something really terrible a long time ago. How do you respond to that?
Well, first is I agree that absolutely I did something really terrible a long time ago. And it's something that that I cannot change, even though I would give anything to be able to change it. I would also say that I know that crimes that are the worst offenses against society need to be punished, and they need to be punished, you know, harshly. But I don't believe that forever hope is just only because I've seen the side of what that does to people in here and the impact that has on the prison environment and the impact that has on public safety. You know, I think that as well, I don't see relief for LWOP as a right. I see it as a mercy. And yeah. And so I'm very cognizant that as we ask for relief, as we ask for opportunities, that we're not asking for anything that we have coming. We're asking for mercy. We're asking for the opportunity. Many of us, myself included, and I'll speak for myself here, I earned my way into prison, and the hope that burns in my heart is that I'll receive the mercy of the opportunity for earning my way out.
And I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us and sharing your experience with us.
No, I thank you for the opportunity to speak and be heard.
We've been talking with Michael Owens. He's at Mule Creek State Prison serving a life without parole sentence. This has been Everyday Injustice. I'm your host, David Greenwald. Join us again next time for more tales from the injustice system.
Thank you to George Powell and Norman Mouse Quake Barrett for the use of our opening, Everyday Injustice. You can see more of George's music at www.justiceforgeorgepowell.com.